May it please the court. We're here, Your Honor, because Mr. Albert, the appellant, seeks to vindicate his constitutional right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. As Section 571070, however, interferes with that right by making it a crime for him to do so. The application of this statute to Mr. Albert violates the Second Amendment because, for the reasons stated in the brief, but the key one I want to focus on here is risk. 571070 is not designed to extend Mr. Albert's sentence. It is a regulatory statute designed to reduce the risk from felons possessing firearms and misusing them to commit crimes cause harm to others. So the risk from Mr. Albert possessing the firearm is the key issue here. The state has conceded that allowing Mr. Albert to possess firearms, as he did for 25 years despite his felony convictions, would pose either no risk to public safety or the public interest, or a risk no different than any other law-abiding citizen exercising the right to bear arms. That is fatal to their case and requires this court to reverse the summary judgment motion that was granted in their favor. That admission was a sensible admission because all the undisputed facts here support it. 1983, the U.S. Attorney General's office conducted a rigorous investigation into Mr. Albert's background and made an express finding that restoring his federal rights, including his right to bear arms, would pose little to no risk to public safety or the public interest. During the 25 years after that restoration, Mr. Albert possessed firearms without incident, no arrests, no crimes.
In your opening, you said that it was the application of 571070 to your client that would violate the Second Amendment. Is that right?
That is correct.
Your analysis would require a more or less case-by-case factual determination.
Well, not always. Our position is Mr. Albert is a member of a group of him and those similarly situated that would have the right to bear arms.
But at a minimum, you'd have to figure out whether the next guy was in that group or not in that group.
Sure, that's always true of constitutional rights. They're individual rights, not group rights. So each person would have to prove their case.
So my question is about jurisdiction and this court's exclusive jurisdiction. Are you challenging the validity of the statute or the application of the statute to your client?
We're challenging the constitutional validity of the statute as applied to Mr. Albert. This court has entertained as applied constitutional challenges. It has not dismissed cases based on lack of jurisdiction. In fact, three of the prior challenges were as applied challenges. They were defeated. The court ruled on the merits on it, didn't dismiss them based on lack of jurisdiction. And that was a sensible approach. They may have also included facial challenge. We also included a facial challenge too, but the facial challenge was rejected. So if the court is saying it has to have a facial challenge before in order to have jurisdiction, it has one. We just lost some of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we're focusing here on the constitutionality as applied to Mr. Albert.
What is the facial challenge?
Well, the facial challenge is that the statute is overbroad and that it is unreclusive and hence flunks strict scrutiny under the Second Amendment. That issue was not presented by the prior cases, which dealt with the Missouri Constitution, Article 1, Section 23's version of strict scrutiny. So we're dealing with different issues here. And the brief explains why it's overbroad. It applies to all convicted felons without recognizing that there's a subgroup of convicted felons whose possession poses a risk no different than a law-abiding citizen's possession. That is duplicative of other federal and state laws that address the compelling state interest posited by it. So at most you get some minor deterrence effect perhaps, and it doesn't have a self-defense exception with State v. Shelby. says is important in trying to determine constitutionality, even under the old reasonable regulation standard review, which is not strict scrutiny under, at least as construed by federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. They're very different things. The other infirmity that applies to Section 571070 is that it's under-inclusive. We know it doesn't apply to any felons, any misdemeanor offenders, even though we know that domestic violence misdemeanor offenders pose a very serious risk, in fact, a risk more serious than many felony offenders, yet they're not included. We've cited the research on that, which is not disputed, that you have about 95-98%, depending on what you look at, percentage of these misdemeanor of the murders involving lovers, wives, you know, whatever, were preceded by domestic violence. And oftentimes these misdemeanor domestic violence offenders are prosecuted as misdemeanor offenders, not because they're not felons, they are felons. But the prosecution will not get the assistance of the victim to prosecute the case if they're charged as felons. There's other reasons why, too. So we think that it's not just the application, Mr. Alpert, is problematic. The whole the structure of it, it's under-inclusive and over-broad, too, at the same time.
And why couldn't your client raise any or all of those arguments as a defense to a prosecution if and when he ever possesses the firearms and if and when he's ever charged and brought to trial?
Well, if he were prosecuted, he could raise it, but that's not an available remedy for him. He's not being prosecuted right now. And this court has recognized
it. Is he even in possession of the firearms right now?
My understanding is he is in possession of no firearms, none. He wants to. He was from 1983 to 2008. There's no requirement that he commit a felony in order to vindicate his constitutional rights. To hold that.
Well, he can't vindicate. He can't commit a felony if your argument is correct, and his conduct would be, if he engaged in it, constitutionally
yes.
protected.
That's true of the Tupper case where this court entertained a challenge to a municipal ordinance, even though there was no pending prosecution, and that was just a red light traffic ticket. Entertained that, even though he could, and those drivers could in the future either run a red light, or perhaps whoever was operating the car run a red light, creating an issue, a pending case. But this court nonetheless entertained the challenge. And the principle that you would have to commit a felony in order to raise your constitutional rights is perverse. It is the whole point of the Declaratory Judgment Act, you can read the statutory text, is to resolve legal uncertainty concerning rights. There's a specific statute that deals with contract issues and says you don't have to breach the contract in order to bring a breach of contract. So it would make the hash of the Declared Judgment Action say, go violate a criminal statute in order to raise your constitutional rights. But if you got a $500 dispute with somebody, a contract dispute, you don't have to do that. You can file your Declaratory Judgment Action. The General Assembly would not intend to basically sacrifice constitutional rights but allow piddling breach of contract actions to be raised by declaratory judgment action. That wouldn't make any sense.
Although courts have said that many times, correct? Courts have said that we don't do declaratory judgments for possible criminal defenses that you may have and may raise if you're ever prosecuted.
They have to be ripe. And so oftentimes this court has said it's not ripe, but they don't say it's necessarily not ripe because there's no pending criminal case. What they say is the facts, there has to be an immediate, concrete dispute caused by the law that's being challenged. That's present here. There's no question. He wants to possess firearms. The statute prohibits him to do it. He says he's got a constitutional right. And the facts necessary to adjudicate the claim have to be fully developed. Here, the facts, there are no, opposed counsel has spotted no facts that would help this court or a future court resolve this dispute. In fact, the facts are undisputed. The facts about, canvas, some of them. There's nothing else that could develop that could make this case go away, or more importantly, because that's the issue, that it would help the court adjudicate the merits of the case. There's none. It's either now or never, because Mr. Albert is not going to go out and commit a crime. He's just not. That would be perverse. It would mean he would have to show that he has no right to bear arms in order to vindicate his right to bear arms. That's absurd. Okay. So I think this case is ripe. There's no currently adequate remedy at law now. There's a hazard from violating it. The facts of this case undermine the summary judgment ruling. And more importantly, I would like this court to focus on two cases that are pretty much on point with Mr. Albert's. There's Binderup versus Holder, which is mentioned. Binderup versus Holder challenged the federal ban on felons in possession successfully. In the district court, it was on appeal to the en banc third court. He prevailed there. And if you compare the cases, Mr. Albert is in a better posture than either Binderup or the other, Alvarez, I believe is the name of the other challenger. Mr. Albert's last crime was 40 years ago. Theirs were much more recent. His underlying felonies are two minor drug possession charges. He, unlike both of those challengers, the Attorney General made a sister sovereign made an express finding that his possession of firearms posed no risks to public safety or public defense.
Counsel, you've made a specific point that your challenge is under the Second Amendment, not under Missouri's Constitution. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, because
and so the majority of federal courts have said that intermediate scrutiny is really most similar to what Heller
applied. I think your count's correct.
If the court were to agree with that, could you address it under intermediate scrutiny as an alternative to your strict scrutiny argument?
The burden would still rest on the state to justify the constitutionality as applied. There would be interest balancing, though. I don't think those cases are correct because Justice Breyer and Heller proposed an interest balancing test, and the majority said, no, that's not what we're doing.
The majority didn't say what they were applying, though, so they left it to the courts, and 9 out of 10, whatever, most of the courts have said it's intermediate. So can you more fully explain why, how, if you do balance interest, why you think it would come out on your side?
Well, the interest on the state is eliminating the risk from Mr. Albert misusing a firearm. The state has conceded that risk is non-existent or less than the risk posed by an average law-abiding citizen who's never committed a crime. To me, that's fatal. The other interest on the other side, Mr. Albert is an old man dying of renal cancer. He needs the firearm for self-defense. He can't use his arms to protect himself. He lives out in the country. There's not much police presence out there. If there's an intruder, he's not going to be able to do much. And he has shown that he not only needs it for self-defense, but he has a business. With this, if his rights to bear arms are restored, he can expand his business as he invested his money to do that. There's all kinds of interest on his side.
Thank you, counsel.
Sorry.
I've taken you past your time. No, my fault.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin with your question, Judge Wilson. Couldn't he raise this as a defense? And the answer is yes. At least four criminal defendants have raised this in a defense and a motion to dismiss. This type of issue, specifically about firearms, in the last couple of years.
What if he loses?
At trial? Uh-huh. Well, then he would have all the appellate review.
No, I mean, what if he loses on appeal? He's wrong. Turns out he doesn't have that right. Then he goes to prison. Is that the only way he can find out if it really constitutionally can apply to him or not?
Well, certainly we have no idea what the trial court or the jury, well, I guess it would be a trial court because he has prior felonies, but we don't know what the trial court sentence would be. But I want to touch on...
Isn't that why our cases do not require someone to commit a crime to challenge a statute?
Well, the general rule is that pre-enforcement challenges are not ripe. And there's a narrow exception for that rule when someone has alleged, specific concrete facts and that the issue is ripe. Here, and something that certainly would be addressed at a trial, what are the facts surrounding this possession? The type of firearm, the scenario.
The fact that he had firearms and had to get rid of them, that he has family guns that he would inherit or would possess because they are left to him. Is that not specific enough?
Not in this case, because there was not a specific fact pleading that he would possess those firearms. He did announce a general desire to possess firearms. He listed those two firearms. I do want to touch on something that, that opposing counsel just mentioned, which is that it's, in his view, perverse to have Mr. Alpert commit a crime. But someone can't vindicate their rights unless there is first a violation of those rights.
But wouldn't he disqualify himself from running firearms by getting one in violation of law? Isn't that the kind of thing that's exactly the kind of fact that would...
But he's already disqualified himself.
I understand. But
and so, you know, if
surely you see the irony in suggesting that.
Mr. Alpert's case is difficult, but this court has been clear, I think, in the Clay decision especially, that felons are belong to a group of individuals that have removed themselves from Second Amendment protections. In this case, we just don't have sufficient facts. This is much like some of the other pre-enforcement challenges that I've cited in the brief, you know, from the Western District, the J.H. Fitchman case, where the business, right, is being threatened with prosecution for possessing and distributing what the officers apparently believe to be paraphernalia. They were not allowed to bring a pre-enforcement challenge because there weren't enough sufficient facts, right, to establish what type of paraphernalia or what the circumstances are.
But your opposing counsel cites pre-enforcement cases, our red light camera cases, in which we went ahead and determined constitutionality of their pre-enforcement.
That's correct.
And how do you distinguish that?
Tupper has a very unique set of facts. In Tupper, frankly, from the court's opinion and from the record, the state took efforts to make those plaintiffs' claims unreviewable. At every turn, the state and Tupper would dismiss the claims or somehow attempt to moot out the case before there could be appellate review. And I think that sort of action, which is not present in this case...
What additional facts are necessary in this case? What is there about this case that we don't know?
So that's sort of a two-part question. The first part, the answer is we don't know what specific firearms, what's the scenario, and those
are...
Is
any of that relevant to the constitutional question?
Well, and that gets to the second part of the answer, which is do you believe or do you accept Mr. Alpert's balancing argument or not? If the court does accept Mr. Alpert's balancing argument, and certainly the state urges this court not to because felons are categorically removed from the Second Amendment. But Mr. Alpert's argument is essentially that he is elderly, that he's sick, that he lives in a location far away from officers. So that puts the court in a very difficult position. What if Mr. Alpert moves 5 minutes from the police station? What if Mr. Alpert makes a recovery? You know, if the court accepts Mr. Alpert's argument that those facts are outcome determinative, then we need to have an establishment of those facts sufficient to make a decision. And it's true that today, or at least at the time that he filed his petition, that was his health status, that was where he lived. But those sort of facts need to be firmed up or sufficiently established, which I think it would happen if Mr. Alpert were to possess firearms illegally. And of course, that's also the assumption that he would be caught and prosecuted. Not every crime is caught or prosecuted. Certainly, it's sort of a presumption that the state enforces its laws, but it's also a presumption that citizens follow those laws. And so in addition to sort of the ripeness...
So you think he would need to get an indication from the state that were he to possess a firearm, it would enforce the laws against him?
That would certainly get Mr. Alpert closer to having a concrete, immediate dispute. I'm not confident that it would get it all the way there, because, of course, Mr. Alpert could move jurisdictions, right? The people of the state of Missouri have chosen to empower prosecutions by local prosecutors, not a centralized authority. So if Mr. Alpert moved from Johnson County to... certainly...
I understand your concern. I don't want to take all your time from addressing the merits of his argument, should we reach that.
Very good. And I will get to the merits in just a moment, Your Honor. I do want to briefly touch on the adequate remedy at law. I know we've been talking a little bit about the ripeness. I think that in this case, Schaefer versus Koster, the DWI case where the individuals had been charged and filed a declaratory judgment action, and this court affirmed the circuit court's decision to dismiss that as an improper challenge. I think that that case is very persuasive on this topic. Understanding that Mr. Alpert has not been yet been charged, but I think in this case that distinction is not enough to remove Mr. Alpert from the adequate remedy of law. Turning to the merits of this case, the court was very clear in Clay. I think the exact language from 536 is that this court already has held that the restriction on the right of felons to possess arms has long been recognized as an exception to the right to bear arms. That, in addition to the language from Heller, demonstrates that felons are categorically removed from Second Amendment protections. So that's the only fact that's relevant in this case, is whether or not Mr. Alpert has a felony. And he has two felonies. That's outcome determinative. Right? Mr. Alpert has committed those felonies. That has removed him from the class of individuals who are protected by the Second Amendment.
So would you, the other individuals that are mentioned in the Heller case as having a, because it's a limited fundamental right, so your thought process is that somebody who has been at one time diagnosed with mental illness, the state could have a statute that permanently forbids anybody from a mental illness or somebody who's been institutionalized for mental illness from ever possessing a firearm.
And Heller does reference the prohibition, the longstanding prohibition of possession of weapons by those who are mentally ill. Mental illness is different, I think, though, than a felony conviction. Mental illness, I think, as this court's recently aware of because of the sexually violent predator cases, mental illness is a status that can change over time. People can be healed. They can get better. The decision to commit a crime and to have that crime be a felony is a permanent mark, unless, of course, an individual receives some sort of pardon or an expungement. So the more difficult question about an individual who was mentally ill and has now recovered is not a question that this court has to reach in this case.
Do we, you raised an issue I wanted to ask, do we know, did this gentleman seek to get his convictions expunged or pardoned or wiped out, and that was denied?
My understanding of the record in this case is that he had filed an application for a pardon in the state system, but there's not been a ruling on it, at least as of the time of the
report. So is that evidence in support of your assertion it's not ripe at this point? Because this claim is based on the fact that he is unable to otherwise get relief, unlike some cases in other. And he draws a distinction between his situation and those who have been pardoned and therefore are able to hold guns, but he hasn't yet finished trying that.
Precisely. And I think that also touches back to a statement Mr. Alpert's counsel just made, which is that nothing in this case could change. Well, not so. He could receive a pardon.
Well, have we ever held that the fact that the governor could grant some form of relief doesn't mean that the constitutional issue is right?
No. It's my understanding that that's an issue of first impression.
Right. Would you think that the court would dodge an Eighth Amendment claim on the fact that the governor could commute a sentence?
No, I do not, Your Honor. But I think the Eighth Amendment context, insofar as the ripeness, I think is an important illustration for this case. That's the Forrest case that's cited in my brief. In that case, the individual raised on PCR that the Missouri's method of execution was unconstitutional as applied to him. And this court said that sort of claim is not ripe because we don't know what method will be used at the actual time of your execution. And as I point out in the brief, this court's wisdom was verified last year when Mr. Force was executed by a totally different method.
But here he's prohibited from possessing a weapon now, not some consequence that may happen at some point in the future where circumstances can be different.
Correct. So the state action in Forrest is what could have changed, not the plaintiff's action. But in this case, it's the plaintiff who could have the changes made, right? He could receive the pardon. And then, of course, you also
What percentage of felons get pardons?
And I don't have that.
It's minuscule, is it not?
I would say it's a rare act of mercy from the governor, yes.
And I was just saying, because he had it pending, that it's still pending at this point, which I thought made it different. But,
right.
Do we know if there's been an attempt to have an expungement, or is that not feasible, or does the record not address that?
The record does not address that.
Thank you. I don't want you to go outside.
Is there any relevance to the fact that this law changed in 2008, but yet he didn't bring the suit to 2015? Does that have any bearing on an immediate concrete dispute?
And I think that's an excellent question. Certainly, Mr. Alpert alleges that during the passage of time, you know, he's run the bullet factory and engaged in sort of that economic activity. But I don't think there's any other indication in the record that would establish that it's a, you know, an immediate dispute between the parties merely because time has passed.
Are there cases that say the opposite, that say because someone who has a claim waited to bring it, that they're prohibited from bringing it?
I'm more familiar with the cases that talk about that in the habeas context, certainly, and having just heard some of the argument from the last case. I know it's a general principle that in terms of equity, people aren't supposed to sleep on their rights.
Well, but, I mean, he may or may not have decided he wanted a gun till now. I mean, I've never heard of that in the constitutional context. Have you?
Right.
And habeas is kind of unique.
Correct. And this case does have some unique facts, but, of course, he hasn't. The facts in this case only establish that he wishes to possess firearms, not, again, which particular ones.
He names two rifles, though, that he would inherit, that he is inherited, right?
That's right. He does describe two World War II-era firearms, but doesn't articulate that he would possess those but for the statute. He does indicate that he wishes to possess them. But I don't know that that's enough, especially given Mr. Alpert's efforts to plead many other facts that are not, I don't think, particularly relevant.
Can you address the level of scrutiny in the time remaining under the Second Amendment, which under Heller, because that's what we're dealing with here?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly the state would prevail under either standard. As far as intermediate scrutiny goes, the state only needs to establish that the statute serves an important government interest, and that the statute is tailored is substantially related to that. And this court has already said in Clay that the felon in possession ban is narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling state interest. So it must be true under Clay that if the statute survives strict scrutiny, it also survives intermediate scrutiny. I know my time is short. Just briefly to conclude on the merits. Again, Mr. Alpert has committed felonies, and that has categorically removed him from the class of people allowed to possess firearms. And the state's decision to prohibit all felons from possessing firearms, I think, as I stated, survives strict scrutiny. And I want to end on one last statement from one of this court's cases in Merritt. This court announced that, or reaffirmed rather, that someone with a felony conviction on his record is more likely than a non-felon to engage in illegal and violent gun use, and that was a sufficient justification for the legislature's decision to ban felons from possessing firearms. That rationale applies in this case, and I would ask that the court affirm the decision of the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor.
Counsel, are any of the firearms that your client would like to possess curio firearms as defined in the statute?
No, they are just concealable firearms. They're not antique or curio firearms.
They're not more than 50 years old and associated with World War
II? No, they might be, but he's not limited to wanting to possess the two that are listed there. He wants to possess the firearms that he possessed before. There is an allegation that he wishes to possess firearms in general, not just those two specific. And on summary judgment, the inference of from the record must be read in light most favorable to my client. So there's certainly nothing in the petition that says he doesn't want to possess any other firearms. It says firearms that are covered by 571070.
Which doesn't cover all firearms.
No, not all firearms, but the ones that he would be prosecuted if he were to possess. There's no disclaimer that he only wants to possess firearms. The whole premise of our litigation is that Section 571070 would threaten him, it with prosecution if he possessed firearms he would possess. And the state, in any event, the state never, the uncontested facts, that's not one of their facts in their motion for summary judgment. So you'd have to be, you'd be affirming it based on a fact that's not the basis for the summary judgment.
But in effect, you're arguing he has a constitutional right not just to possess a firearm, but any firearm he wants.
I'm not taking the position that he can stockpile firearms. The right to bear arms is not the right to start an army. He wants to possess a firearm in a reasonable manner. The state's free to do reasonable regulations. I believe that the state can limit the number of firearms that people can possess, and it depends on whether you're a dealer or an individual person. Our position is not he can own a million firearms and go out and do whatever, start his own army. It's definitely not a position. Firearms, plural, but that doesn't mean, bazookas, okay, whatever the case may be.
If next week we decide this question in a criminal appeal by another defendant, and we were to adopt your position, would your client be any worse off with that decision than he would be if he got that decision in this case with his name at the top?
The problem is this court has already, if you had a challenger that's similarly situated to Mr. Albert, and you ruled in his favor, then Mr. Albert would benefit from that. But I know of no cases in the pipeline where that's so. And the availability of relief to some other person doesn't mean that my client already has a remedy available. That's a remedy for somebody else. He's trying to vindicate his rights. I would say that is speculative at this point whether any such person would ever raise a challenge like Mr. Albert's. I would urge the court to reverse the judgment of the Circuit Court of Johnson County, remand the case for either for entry of judgment in favor of my client or else for trial on the merits.
Thank you for a well-argued case.